All right, welcome everyone. If you're just coming in, welcome in. We'll let everybody get logged in and we'll get started in about a minute. Okay, welcome everyone. It looks like the waiting room is back and online. So welcome everybody. We are very excited to have all of you with us tonight. Or perhaps it's really late at night or early morning, depending on where you are at. Friends, family, colleagues, current and former Tucker team members and Tucker Center affiliated scholars, welcome. I'm Dr. Nicole Lavoie. I am the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. My pronouns are she, her. And if you don't know, the Tucker Center is the first of its kind research center dedicated to accelerating systems change for girls and women in sport through our research, education, and outreach. If you are here, you're about to enjoy a very timely and relevant panel discussion on LFG. Stands for, is a documentary feature centering on the United States women national soccer team and their public and very controversial fight for equal pay. The premise of the fight and the movie, if you haven't watched it, is this. This is my summary. Women do the same job with the same employer on the same field, are better performing, meaning they win more, and they are paid less, a lot less. And these women, arguably some of the best in the world, felt they deserve to be paid equally and not just be grateful for the opportunity to play. So when we picked this film, we had no idea that the news of the pending settlement between the U.S. National Women's Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation would break today. So their ongoing fight for the last 6 years, if you haven't seen the news, which I'm sure many of you have, resulted in a $24 million settlement pending the collective bargaining agreement, equal pay and bonus structure to men. However, the downside is the $24 million is only one-third of what they actually were seeking, which was $66 million. I'm sure we're going to talk about that. So when we streamed LFG for free in partnership with CNN Films and HBO Max, it was part of our 12th annual Women in Sport Film Festival that we host every year to celebrate National Girls and Women's Sport Day. So due to the breaking news, we got CNN Films and HBO to agree to extend the viewing of LFG through Thursday. So if you have friends and family and colleagues and students that haven't seen it, they have another couple days to do so. So tell everyone. So I could not be more excited for our panel discussion tonight with three of my colleagues to get their insights, their perspectives on women's soccer, the fight for gender equity, pay equality, and so much more. I'm going to first introduce the panelists, and I want you to follow them on social, connect with them on LinkedIn, because part of these conversations is connecting like-minded people together in the world of girls and women in sport and gender sport scholarship. So what we'll do tonight is I'll introduce everyone, then they'll tell you a little bit more about themselves and their expertise related to the topic. Then we're going to have a discussion, and then we're going to open it up for questions. So if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A function on Zoom down at the bottom of your screen. But before I begin, I would like to give a special shout out and thank you to the Tucker team behind the scenes. no good work goes done alone. And the Tucker team is an amazing group. Courtney Boucher, Afrod Abadi, Hannah Silva Breen, and Jonathan Sweet. Thank you. I could not do what we do in the Tucker Center without you. All right, so we only have 1 hour and lots to talk about, so let's get to it. Are we ready? Panelists, if you could please join me on screen, I will introduce you. Awesome. It looks like Missy's already raising her hand. All right, so panelists in alphabetical order. First, we have Dr. Rachel Allison. She is an associate professor of sociology at Mississippi State University. Her research focuses on gender and intersectionality, and she is the author, if you don't know it, of the 2018 book, Kicking Center, Gender and the Selling of Women's Professional Soccer. Welcome, Dr. Allison.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thanks for joining everyone.
Absolutely. Okay, so as I introduce each panelist, I have one sort of warm-up question for each panelist as I introduce you. So we're going to start with you, Dr. Allison. If you could invite one dream panelist to join us tonight, who would it be and why? No judgment, no right or wrong answer. Who do you got?
Honestly, I'm gonna say I would invite Christine Lilly, a former women's national team player, someone that I kind of grew up watching and really have admired. And I would love to kind of hear her take on kind of seeing where the team is at now.
Okay, great. She'll be a dream virtual guest panelist. All right, next panelist joining us from Arizona State University is Dr. Tarlone Chartavalli, a postdoctoral research scholar at the Global Sport Institute, which I'm a big fan of. Hello to everyone from GSI who might be on the call. In her research, she focuses on improving diversity, identifying structural inequalities, policymaking, and gender equity in sport. Welcome, Dr. Chartavalli. Who is your dream panelist and why?
Hello, and thank you so much for your invitation and for everyone attending this panel today. It's hard, a lot of people come to mind, but when you asked Dr. Allison that question, the first person that came to my mind was Marta. I think she's undoubtedly one of the best soccer players in the world, who I don't think has received the acknowledgement that she deserves, partly you can say financially as well. Okay. So yeah, I would like to hear her thoughts and have her on this panel.
I love it. Agree. Okay, last but not least, Dr. Missy Price, who just knows a little bit about soccer. She is the outgoing head soccer coach at Wellesley College, Go Blue, is just completing her term as president of the United Soccer Coaches Board of Directors, and is coming to us from under her packing boxes as she and her family are moving to Tampa, where she will begin her new position as the vice president of women's soccer for the United Soccer League, USL. Welcome, dear friend and Dr. Price. Thank you for joining us amidst a major family move. Who's your dream panelist and why?
Well, first of all, thank you, Nicole. And I'm actually really excited to be here. I couldn't believe it when I woke up this morning and saw the news and the timing of that. So this was already something special in my calendar, and for some reason it feels a little extra special. My dream panelist would be Jill Ellis. And I have a personal connection to Jill in that she was an assistant coach at the University of Maryland when I played there. But I also think that she was the coach of the national team at a very critical time. Now, they've been fighting for this for a long time, so there's been many head coaches that have been part of this. But I think when you talk about the most recent events around this lawsuit, I would love to have Jill on here to sort of tell us from her side, both as a woman in the industry, as the head coach of the team at the time, as someone now who is president of a professional team in our country, just what this means for women's soccer, from youth grassroots all the way up to the pros here and in the world. So I think it'd be cool to have her perspective.
All right. I that's a good one. And my guest dream panelist, I'm going to go out into left field. I'd like to hear from Carlos Cordera.
That's a good one.
I have some questions for him. For those of you who don't know who that is, he is the former president of the U.S. Soccer Federation and is currently rerunning for president to replace the current president. Okay. All right. So let's get to it. So I want all of you each just to take 2 minutes to give us a little more context to set the stage for a conversation in your particular areas of expertise. I couldn't do it justice in introducing you in a 2-sentence bio. So how specifically are you connected to the content in this film? And we'll just go alphabetical again for this one. Rachel, tell us about your contextual expertise here.
Sure. So I'm a sociologist, I think, as you mentioned, and most of my research has focused on women's soccer, especially at the professional level. And so my book focused on a women's professional league that predated the current league. So now I kind of think of that as research kind of before this contemporary era. But the book really looks at the marketing and selling of women's soccer, as well as some of the barriers to kind of seeing the value and kind of getting the recognition and resources in women's sport in general. And so since that book was published in 2018, I've kind of shifted to study women's soccer fans primarily. So most recently I was at the 2019 Women's World Cup, both observing in fan spaces and collecting data that way, and also talking to a lot of adults in the US and other countries that traveled to France to kind of get their perspectives on what was going on during this tournament.
Okay. Great. Tarlone, how about you?
Yes, I'm next. Yes. So my research revolves around understanding women's labor in a sport and how women's labor has been undervalued in various contexts. For my doctoral dissertation, I examined National Women's Soccer League players' attitude towards their labor value, towards their job, towards the resources that they were receiving to basically valorize their labor, because we often hear the excuse of revenues as a justification to not pay women what they are worth. To what they're asking. And I wanted to examine the impacts of different gaps in producing this bigger gender pay gap and the revenues that is often used. So I examined players' access to facilities, to coaching, where they live, how far from their practice facilities they were living, how far did they have to drive, the coaches that they had, how qualified they were, and so forth, to really understand the relationship between all these different networks that then impacts the product of women on the field. So in a nutshell, my goal was to challenge the sort of simplistic view that revenues can determine the value of laborers, of workers, and therefore their salary.
Okay. So we're going to come back to that as it relates to the breaking news, but we're so happy to have your perspective on the panel tonight. And I was, as I was reading the book and I was reading your dissertation, I was like really impressed with how your knowledge bases really are synergistic. So Missy, tell us a little bit about your perspective on this topic for tonight and set the stage for us.
Yeah, so for me, I'm coming at this, so I do have a PhD in sports psychology, but I don't do a lot of active research. Most of my experience has been developing coaches and developing sort of the environment that players are playing in, and coaches being a significant part of that. Mm-hmm. But my new role at the USL is vice president of women's soccer, and the United Soccer League, so the USL, has a really strong platform or pathway for men's soccer, from pre-professional or youth academy, even youth academy, pre-professional and professional levels. And they have put their resources, both human and financial, behind developing a pathway for women mm-hmm. and girls. And so what you're seeing is the relaunch of the W League, which starts this May in 45 cities. And the W League is a place for players to play where you're not being paid to play. So it's not a professional league. Think about most of the players in the league would be players who are playing probably in their college career. So the league runs from May to the end of July. So kind of that summer break for them in college. That's not the only sort of person who you might find playing in the league, but it's probably the majority. Mm-hmm. And then in 2023, we are launching a professional league for women to play in called the USL Super League. And that will be another place for women to play professionally. And in both of these leagues, we're not just talking about the players, but you're talking about opportunities for women to work in the sport, whether that is technical staff, coaches, people like that, or athletic trainers, video analysts, front office, anyone. If you're thinking about general managers, presidents, owners, people who work in marketing, communications, I mean, just start listing off positions in a professional atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so the Super League is the Women's Professional League that's launching in 2023. The W League is what we call a pre-professional, or a place where players are playing and not being paid to play, but you're getting expenses and things like that covered. And then you're probably going to see some things in the future that are supporting that more of the youth game and that transition of youth to college to professional. So it's a really exciting position. Until about 3 months ago, the position did not exist anywhere in our country. So that really shows you, I think, the commitment that the USL has to supporting women's soccer. And it's super exciting.
Yeah, and I love that we've got Rachel, whose primary research was with the WPS. And Tarlone looked at the NWSL, and Missy, you know both leagues quite well, but you're part of a new league, mm-hmm. really, and creating opportunities for women in the USL. And I do have to say, because I saw Dr. Austin Stair Calhoun's chat, hey, Austin, I do have to say, Austin was, this film fest is Austin's brainchild. So thank you to Austin. We're on the screen because of you. Austin is a Tucker team member, 12 years in the running. Yes, Film Fest. And she said in the chat, go Aurora. That's our Minnesota W League team. We're very excited. And I was really hoping that my scarf came in the mail today, because I got notice it had shipped, but it hasn't been delivered because I really wanted to wear it tonight. We're very excited. So we have a lot of the spectrum of perspectives here. And I think one of the things that stood out for me is about women creating opportunities for other women. You mentioned Jill Ellis or Julie Ehrman, who's the with Angel City, is that they're intentionally creating opportunities for women on their staff, their trainers, their front office, from top to bottom. And I think that's a really good model for us to keep our eyes on, and our own team here in Minnesota too, the Aurora. So, all right. So we have a lot of expertise on the screen. So let's get into it here. When you first heard the news today, right? What was your first thought? And I'll just open it up and then we'll get into some more specific questions.
I mean, I felt incredibly excited to see this news. It's obviously been a fight that we've known about publicly since, you know, 2015, but as Missy mentioned earlier, has been going on for, you know, since the inception of the women's national team in mm-hmm. various forms. And so to see this kind of evidence of kind of forward progress is incredibly exciting. And I also just can imagine, you know, what a sense of relief many of the players are feeling, because watching this documentary, you really get a sense for how much time and energy that and probably money, right? This is taking for many of them to pursue this while still in season and, like, you know, going above and beyond and in terms of what they need to do to make this happen. And so I can just imagine, like, the collective sigh, right, that we could imagine from some of the players to say, you know, like, finally this particular battle, you know, seems to be ending. Of course, then the next ones will begin.
Yeah. So to that point, Rachel, since I've got you on the hook right now, how do you see this film and what the news that's breaking today? How would you frame that up as, like, kicking center, right? That's the title of your book. So how do you see that?
Yeah. So what I mean by kicking center is really women's sport fighting to kind of break into the mainstream of a professional sports culture in this country, a culture that historically has been dominated by men's sport, and particularly kind of the big three of men's football, basketball, baseball. And I think that's something that I kind of documented in the book, is this process. And it's what we see in today's news, is that's exactly what's happening here, is trying to kind of push forward to get the types of visibility and recognition and, you know, a value, especially that men have.
Mm-hmm. And do you write in your book that the WPS, the fight for the women's recognition in the WPS, which was the past league, sort of denied the recognition of others because of the hetero, sexy, white, class-based appeal of that league. Do you think that's true of the NWSL and the current national team as well?
Yeah, some of those dynamics I perceive to have shifted dramatically in some cases. The league that I documented, it was absolutely kind of marketing around the idea of the kind of hetero family as their target audience. It really kind of was silent on the question of players' own sexualities. It wasn't as activist. It wasn't as the kind of feminist identified as we see now. And a lot of that has changed. Obviously, many of the players now are kind of publicly out, and many teams then have pride nights and are very celebratory in that sense. And so there's definitely been a shifting culture in terms of sexuality. I do think still there's work to be done in terms of inclusivity around both class and race. Mm-hmm. And I've been very, you know, excited to see the work of the Black Women Players Collective in the NWSL, because I think that's going to be an important place where we see this work come from.
Great. And we have to give a shout out to your special guest over your shoulder, a caricature of...
Yeah, Megan Rapinoe decided to join us this evening, of course.
Excellent. Yes, very much in spirit. So going off that, Tarlone, in your work, what Rachel mentioned about sort of the invisible labor of women and how maybe this news of the pending settlement landed with you today, what was your first thought?
That's actually funny that Rachel just showed Megan Rapinoe's caricature. I really want to echo Megan Rapinoe's comment today that this decision was an important step in righting the many wrongs of the past. And the first thing that came to my mind when I read that statement was, I felt really hopeful, but I was also hoping that this wonderful decision and its impacts get extended to NWSL, to other women's leagues, other women's sport. I think U.S. Women National Team had a great fight because they were the best on earth, and they were yet challenging their employer for not acknowledging their worth. And this is also mentioned during the documentary that women have to be so good at what they do. They have to be exceptional to basically bargain for their worth and ask to be treated fairly. So my hope is that this positive impact gets extended and that average players also get recognition. So young girls and boys who are watching this documentary, this decision, don't feel like they have to be extraordinary. They have to be one of the very few to be able to negotiate for their worth like this. And you mentioned the invisible labor of women. I think that we might talk about the documentary later on, but I think they do a fascinating job at showing the invisible labor of being a soccer player, a female soccer player, having a child, having to care for your child. That is still seeing childcare, domestic labor as the responsibility of women. Women are now working second and third shifts. Despite having success on the job market, and based on my research with NWSL players, something quite fascinating I found that was that players in the NWSL and other leagues, I assume the same, can't even have partners really because they're always moving. They're not in one place. So it's really hard. I'm not saying they don't have partners. It's really hard to maintain relationships when you're getting traded so often, when you're not getting paid much to support your partner. So your partner has to maintain themselves. How are they going to be moving with you so much? A lot of male athletes have spouses, have partners who can fulfill that responsibility if they have a family because they get paid well enough to support their family, but that's not the case for women. And I think they also did a good job of showing the invisible labor of filing a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. There is a part in the movie that Megan Rapinoe talks about hours and hours and hours and hours. She literally repeats that, going through lines by lines of their own contract, the men's contract, to spot inconsistencies, to find out what are they getting that women are not. That's all labor. That's all work. And it's also putting yourself out there, right? It's a lot of emotional labor as well that I think needs to get acknowledged. And I'm hoping that we are sort of on the right path. At least this morning felt that way.
Yeah. One thing that struck me is the invisible labor. Maybe it wasn't so invisible, not in the film. It was fairly laid out bare. Is that the women are responsible for fighting for the women.
Yes, that is a unique aspect of women's sport. And that's actually something I'm currently researching. The expectation from of women to invest in the future of their own sport. Mm-hmm. You even hear Megan Rapinoe. I don't mean to just highlight her, but that's something I remember she saying, that we're doing this fight so the future generation will have a better league, have a better U.S. Soccer Federation. And I think that's kind of consistent across women's soccer, female athletes, to be really investing in the future of their own sport for the benefit of others. Mm-hmm. That is future generation of athletes or their sport governing bodies or sponsors, the expectation to promote their own sport, that is really solely put upon women in a lot of instances, to promote their own sport, to get out there, sign autographs, smile, talk to kids, be out there, do these community appearances that they used to be unpaid. Then they got better in NWSL. They were paid for pair days and traveling and gas money. And I think they're doing a better job now. But I talked to a player who was married to a professional athlete who would get paid the same amount for 1 hour of doing community appearance that she was earning for an entire season playing NWSL 2016.
Ouch. Wow. Yeah, those disparities, when you look at the numbers, I was talking to some of my students about this morning, and when you just look at the disparity of the money and some of those stats they put up on the screen around bonuses and payouts, and it got my blood boiling. If I ring my soccer bell, couldn't resist. Okay, Missy, how did this land with you when you heard the news? You were actually the first one to email me this morning, bright and early, saying, FYI, you might want to know about this for our panel tonight. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. I can't take 100% credit for it. Our communications department was on top of it at the USL. So they had dumped it in my email box pretty early too. But you know, my take on it is, and we've mentioned Megan Rapinoe a lot, but I think it was her in the movie that said activism is life. And I feel like as a woman in this sport, mostly in my role as a coach and as in president of United Soccer Coaches, that rings really true to me. And in the relationships that I've had with some former national team players. So not just consuming that through social media or through media or through things I'm reading, but actually through knowing some of these players and knowing their experiences. And then when sort of the data comes out to back it up. So even if you take sort of the examples of the first steps to equality, we're like, let's just get hotel rooms that are actually nice and comfortable for us to stay in that are similar to what men are getting or something like that, right? So like it started very simply that, and they referenced that in the movie. So for me, as someone who was out of college when the 99ers won the World Cup, and I was like, oh, this is it. Like things are gonna start to change and women's soccer is gonna continue to grow in our country. And there's been multiple iterations, but there's still been this sort of long going battle or struggle or activism happening, whether it's been very public facing to someone other than a consumer of women's soccer, right? Other than a fan, mm-hmm. of the players fighting for the things that they knew that were not equal. And for me now in the position that I'm in as vice president of women's soccer at the USL, and if you take just the Super League, that's going to be a professional women's soccer league that launches, you know, the Super League, it's going to be a highly competitive environment. It's going to center on player experience, deliver like a first-class soccer experience to fans. Like these are goals, right, that we're looking into, but also like it's not just the experience of the players, but the experience of everyone working in the league, mm-hmm. and sort of consuming the product of soccer being played, but not just the product of it, but the connection to community and the connection to developing women's sport. And in this case, women's soccer, and being committed to that. So like when the idea of like activism is life, when Rapinoe mentioned that, I was like, this is what I'm doing. So I feel like part of my role is being an activist for women's soccer in particular, whereas other people are doing that in other sports. But from day one, when you talk about the launch of the Super League, for example, so again, professional women's soccer, we're focused on providing a fair, just, equitable destination for players and everyone who's involved. Like that's at the core of what we're trying to do. So this is like huge. Like I was like, this is awesome. This helps me do my job. Yes. You know, but it's also like, it's about time for someone who was old enough when the 99ers won to sort of feel momentum, mm-hmm. and feel like, you know, my analogy would be, it's like a gas pedal on a car. Like you're able to, we pushed it down a few times and we gained ground. There was acceleration with growth and exposure and support, you name it, whether that's financial or time or other resources. And then we had to like back off the gas pedal, or they were pounding the gas pedal down and the wheels were just sort of spinning, mm-hmm. is the analogy for me. And I think the movie really, what really rung true to me as someone who's really invested in developing the women's game in our country and even globally, is what the women players have sort of been, again, asked to do, to Tarlon's point, like you're not just a player, you're training, you're recovering, you're working. No, so they have a kind of a thing right now called no more side hustles. So like doing all the stuff on the side to make a living that they have to do, not just appearances, not just like the coaching, the this, the that, whatever it might be to make a living. You're also a family member, maybe a partner, who knows what your roles are. And I think that gets overlooked because especially for our women's national team, because they are such high performers. Right. And sometimes women who are high performers are just perceived that like it's easy for them and they get everything right. And they're sort of perfect. And whereas maybe a male athlete, they really worked hard for that. And that women aren't working necessarily as hard. And that was kind of referenced in the movie a little bit. And it's like, everyone works hard. But that it's easier for the women to have won World Cups, for example, if you just talk about soccer, because of the level of competition or this or that. And I just think that that's an unfair assumption. It's also incorrect. And we could get into the research that's now being done because of all the equal pay on the differences between men's and women's soccer, just the gameplay. Take out all the other things, like should the women be paid? Is it equitable? Like, is the game the same? And there's research to say it's all not all that different. There's some research, depending on where you read, that says it is a little different. And I think that's a whole nother sort of topic.
It might be another panel.
Yeah, that's a whole other panel on the sport.
Let me just jump in. And Rachel or Tarlone, do you want to react to what Missy just said?
Are we going alphabetically?
No, just jump in.
I think that is a very pseudoscientific response to equal pay, that women don't work as hard. I mean, there was a time that women World Cup games were 80 minutes, and that was really basically to put limitations on women's bodies and what women are capable of doing. And they extended that, and are women not able to run 90 minutes? No, they are. So I think that argument doesn't have much merit if you are really invested in understanding the workings of the game, and not just women's sport, not just women's soccer, any sport. These athletes are working hard, sweating, lifting, running, doing the same exact thing that male athletes are doing. If there is an argument to be made, you can even make that argument that women have to work harder. I don't know about that, but again, there is all this additional expectations that are put upon women, the additional jobs that they have to get, the side hustles to sustain themselves. Where male athletes get to rest their bodies, focus on the training tomorrow. NWSL players, and I say that because the condition is better for U.S. women national players than an average NWSL player, average soccer player. They're working as a dog walker, as a cashier. They are coaching. Coaching is the number one job that these athletes have on the side. And through that, they're again inspiring the next generation of athletes. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have to be that way. When we think of professional athlete, no one is thinking of an athlete who's working at a supermarket, right? Or who's waiting tables, but that is the case in women's soccer and women's sport. And these are incredibly capable athletes who've been invested in their sport from a really young age. And it's just unfortunate to see that they have to work additionally to sustain themselves. But NWSL very recently signed a new collective bargaining agreement. They are raising the minimum salary. So really hoping to see some changes in the league. And this all seems like good news so far. It hasn't been this way for a really long time. But now we're hearing all this good news, and it's very exciting.
Yeah. Rachel, what do you want to add to that?
Yeah. So I'm thinking about what we've been talking about, and I want to kind of connect it to fans, because I know, Missy, you brought up fans and like also considering the fan experience. And so I'm thinking here that, so in 2020, when US soccer kind of came out with these like offensive legal arguments, right, that kind of justified inequitable pay on the basis of, you know, biological gender difference, they were kind of roundly refuted, right? They clearly walked that back very quickly. And yet, you know, in my book, in my previous research, I found that type of narrative to be really predominant in the way that we often talk about women's sports, and especially in the context of professional women's sports, where we're also talking about revenue, then often that becomes linked to fans and the assumption that if there are these differences, that you know, women are somehow inferior athletes to men, and that means there's less interest in women's sports. There are fewer people who want to watch. Therefore, right, it's not worth giving them investment in the form of television attention, sponsor deals, pay, et cetera, right? So it's kind of like really like linked up logic here that there's like gender difference and then there's low interest. And so there should be low resource and reward. And so I know that, you know, the Tucker Center has done a fantastic job over time of highlighting this narrative, right? That somehow no one is interested in women's sports. And of course we've always known, right? I think those of us who've studied women's sports, that this isn't the case. There've always been highly dedicated fans in women's soccer, as early as I started studying it. And yet I think like, especially now, there's just no possible way that narrative can hold up anymore, because we have seen such overwhelming evidence of interest in women's soccer. If you look at, you know, viewership figures for televised games and in-person attendances, social media engagement, like by all of these metrics, there's large interest, in some cases even more interest, right, for in women's games than in men's. If you look at, you know, the 2015 Women's World Cup final and its numbers, for instance, that's the most watched soccer game of all time in the U.S. On TV. And so the fans are really important and they play a really important role. And what I'm finding, you know, now in my research is just how much of this work of kind of activism, right, that a lot of athletes kind of feel is inherently part of being a female athlete is what fans are also taking on to some extent. Many fans, in fact, that's often what motivates fandom, at least in part, among the people I've been interviewing recently, is this also this commitment to equality in sport and a commitment to using the voice they have on social media or the power they might have as a collective or as a fan club, for instance, to also fight for change. And I think you see that in the documentary a little bit too. There's a moment where Molly Levinson says, you know, I think US soccer is going to get dragged into equal pay. And I think partly that's what happened here, you know, is that public sentiment was with the players. And that was certainly true on the part of some, you know, elected officials and, you know, Oprah and sponsors and corporations like Luna Bar, but it was also the voices of fans, and that really helped kind of drive this change, at least in part.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I do want to invite everyone on this screen, live and behind the scenes, and all our listeners who will listen to this into the future, join us in the campaign on Here's Proof. Right? So if you see sold out stadiums, if you see fans in the stands, and there's proof that people are interested in women's sport, take a picture of it and post it with the hashtag Here's Proof, because we know people are interested in women's sport. And when I'll quote Dr. Kane, because it would not be a Tucker Center event without evoking Dr. Mary Jo Kane, is she has said often, it's not that people aren't interested in sport, it's that they are not interested in women's sport, and they meaning men. So we like to refute that with data. So join us in the Here's Proof. Okay, so now I am attentive to time, and we wanted to keep this to an hour, and I'm really regretting that decision because I think that this is a much longer conversation. But I do want to get to some questions that are coming up in the chat. So I'm going to invite Courtney Boucher, a current Tucker Center team member and doctoral candidate on the Tucker team. She's been monitoring the Q&A, And so she's going to pose some questions to us. So, hey, Court, welcome.
Well, all, thank you for having me. I think a really good place to start that's been kind of coming up in the chat is, I know it's all of our jobs kind of in the sports world to be informed on what's happening, but as we all know, this news is breaking. So can we just get an idea of the terms of the settlement and the news that came out today? Just what does that look like for the players? Are they kind of paying out past players? Are they just setting up equity for those players in the future? What does that look like from our understanding of it right now?
I love your jersey.
Who wants to take that one? Don't be shy.
Well, I was reading the question in the chat, and since I'm not a multitasker, I could only give my attention to the question in the chat. Do you mind repeating your question, Courtney?
Yeah, I think just really, really, and I understand that it's like breaking news. So like we probably all haven't had time because we've been in our work days to really dive into it. But if we could just give the audience, some of whom are kind of just getting into this space, like this might be their first exposure, having watched the film of today, a settlement breaks between U.S. Soccer and the players. What does that settlement really entail? Is it focused on, oh, let's just pay those players who came forward that we saw in the film? Or is it not that, and it's we're going to pay the future players? Or is it a mixture of both? Do we have an understanding of what that looks like at this time?
I can go ahead. So I think this is a breaking news and it's evolving, but from what has been shared with us so far, women were asking, as Nicole mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, they were asking for $66.7 million in back pay. They're getting 22 million will be the back pay that they were asking, and 2 million of that is going to be put in an account that will support players post career goals and their charitable efforts, and really from what I have learned to help grow the women's game. And players apparently can apply for up to $50,000 to pull from that fund. It's really interesting to see if players in the previous generations on the U.S. Women National Team can also access that money. Who are the people who can ask for that? But again, as Nicole mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the amount and some of the details of it are all based or contingent upon the women signing their CBA, which expires at the end of March. Interestingly, men have been playing on an expired CBA since 2018. Oh. Yes, but I read that they're trying to negotiate very similar CBAs, and the idea is that whatever women deem equal will be equal, so they will be a part of the conversation throughout this process. Mm-hmm.
One thing in the film that just popped into my head is when, I think it was again Megan Rapinoe, she's like, the women were getting blamed for signing their current CBA, and so how can they be against it because they signed it? And she's like, but we didn't know there was an alternative to what, you know, what the men had. If we would have seen that one, we would have maybe had a different discussion. So I thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah, they were not offered the same contract.
No.
Great. So I'm wondering, and this came up in the chat as well, and Tarlon, you just said it, and Dr. LeBoy, you said it at the beginning, that the film estimates over $60 million, I think $67 million should be awarded in back pay damages. And then we see those numbers today that estimate $22 million to the players as direct compensation. So do we consider that a win?
I think we consider that a compromise to get where we got to today.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say it's good for the game. It's another step forward. the next CBA that was just mentioned between the Federation and the players will be yet another. And so I think it's an indication of forward progress. And I think there's still the what is yet to be, and we'll all be watching.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the comments that I'm seeing as well, because a lot of us study and research and think about systems change, is that this is one step, but you don't just, I mean, you don't just throw money at the problem and hope that the system changes, right? So I think the hard work and changing the system that's equitable for women, all women, we have some way to go about that. Although, if someone wanted to throw money my way, I'd be happy to try to change the system. So I'm not dismissing that.
And I think one of the, you know, I know we'll probably talk at the end about kind of where we go from here and next steps, but obviously if we're thinking about the larger system, we can't also ignore all of the, you know, allegations of abuse, you know, emotional, verbal, sexual, that have come to light in women's pro soccer in the last several years. And that's also part of the system. And so, you know, creating new practices and policies around investigation and channels for reporting and true accountability, and even in many cases, kind of rethinking who is in charge and who has control and power in women's soccer are some next steps and some other conversations that we will be having about the system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
I would like to go ahead.
Go ahead, Tarlon.
I would like to answer a question that Dr. Cookie is asking in the chat about how this will shift the power dynamics for the next generations. I think this is a slow change, but I think it is a change, and it is sort of a nudge to the system, and it will take time. But I think what the settlement today is showing that the U.S. Soccer Federation, as this giant governing body for soccer in the U.S., is willing to value women's work. When they came out in 2020, when the legal team came out and said that women do not have the same physical ability or the responsibility as male athletes, what they were doing basically was to telling everyone in the world that our women are not valuable. If you have the U.S. Soccer Federation themselves telling you that, how would we expect fans, sponsors, investors to think that this is a valuable investment? And I think that is shifting now. And that is a great, very important shift to come that will impact the women's game. And I think its impact will extend beyond women's soccer. Some people might just see it as $22 or $24 million given to the players, but I think more than that, it's a statement that the women's game is valuable, that they're willing to make the compromise to, they're trying to work it out and even equalize the money that FIFA gives out for tournament wins. So I think it's an important statement that will leave long after us and after this generation of players.
Mm-hmm. One question that came through in the chat kind of, in that same realm is, do you think this settlement influences other professional sports that also see inequity in general, but also pay inequity? I'm thinking the WNBA. Do we think this has some sort of leverage or inspiration in those leagues, or does the buck stop here?
I guess that's TBD, isn't it? I mean, I think I saw that question too, Court, and I think there seems, and this might just be my perception, but there seems to be sort of a growing disruption in the space of women's sport from multiple perspectives. And this news today is just the next example of that disruption, whether it be data disruptions, digital disruptions, activism disruptions, legal disruptions, that there's sort of and women in positions of power in sport like Missy that are now getting to places where they can create change and move that big flywheel. I think that we're, and I know every year it's like, this is the year of the woman. I'm like, please don't say that again. But there might be some real opportunities to create change here. So I guess we'll see. I would like to think that it would give some leverage to other leagues. I don't know. What do all of you think?
I'd actually love to hear from Missy. Yeah, I was going to say Missy should take this one.
I mean, I think it, I would hope it's going to help us do our job of building a women's pathway at the USL. But I think we are seeing organizations, associations, companies starting to have a more outward facing stance on equality. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's still, you know, whether that's in, again, sport or other business, I still think there's obviously tremendous strides we need to continue to make. But one example is in the film, the article, or not the article, the full page ad that Secret put in there, right? And it was really boiled down to the values that we have. And I can speak for my organization, both as former president of United Soccer Coaches, so developing equal or equitable opportunities, not just for women, but even recognizing that perhaps women of color in coaching have different challenges or accessibility issues or anything that we could be helping them with. And then taking that a step further in my role now as vice president of women's soccer at the USL, is the opportunities. We talk about there's roughly 40,000 players playing college soccer across all divisions, right? It's round numbers here. U.S. Youth Soccer tells us that there's roughly 3 million youth playing soccer in our country, with about half of that being girls, roughly again. So you're talking about lots of people who may want to be players, owners, general managers, the head of the marketing department, you know, the head of sport performance, the head coach, the assistant coach, the goalkeeper coach. Like, there's so many opportunities. And that's why I took the job at the USL. So to your point, Nicole, to try to make a larger impact, because I value it and my organization values it. And I think that is where the difference comes in, is aligning all of us that value it, whether that's companies, researchers, industry leaders and professionals. I mean, you have a whole league right now who said, we have men's soccer and we do pretty good at it. Let's invest in the women because it's important.
Yeah. So I have one last question for everyone, sort of a whip around here. And we have lots of so many good questions in the chat and in the Q&A. Maybe we'll have to have part two. The band gets back together and talks more about this. But, you know, this is a win at the highest level of women's sport, particularly for women's soccer. What do we take away from this in the trickle-down effect from, you know, college to club to youth to grassroots level sport? How do we, and I'm going to steal this from Rachel's book, how do we kick it forward? And what can we take away to create and sustain systems change from the bottom up? Any thoughts on that?
I think I'll go. I think it all boils down to everyone reevaluating the ways they have been valuing women's work and women's sport. I'm not saying this because I research women's labor and the value of women's work, but that really, that's really it. In 2019, after US Women National Team won their fourth World Cup, Nike only made 1,000 jerseys. to sell to the fans. The fans were, they sold out immediately, and the fans were waiting for months to be able to buy the jerseys. What does that mean? That is basically Nike, as one of the biggest sportswear brands in the world, undervaluing women's sport, not believing that there is demand for it. We always hear this argument, if there's supply and demand, if there is demand for it, you know, there would be supply, it all work together. But Nike really underestimated the demand for women's jerseys and therefore ended up selling those many jerseys. And people can go back and look at that and say, oh, look, they only bought 1,000 jerseys. Well, because Nike only made 1,000 jerseys. So I think it's, that was a good lesson for Nike and for everyone. And I think today's decision to invest in women's game, put women's game on TV. And I think the campaign that here's proof, that's fascinating. I don't know who started it, but I'm going to go do some research and find out. Do you know?
We started it.
Okay.
Another call out to Austin Calhoun who was in the office when this idea got born. So I have to say that I think Katie LaBelle is on the thread here. I can hear Katie in the background because this is her area of research around women's merchandise and the undermarketing and underselling of merch for women's sport. And just a plug for future Tucker Center panel discussion, within the next month and a half, we're going to have another one of these with Katie, Ann Peguero, Dunia Antunovich, myself, and Nancy Lowe, talking about what we're calling a new model of women's sport that really gets around the business imperative of women's sport, including merchandise, including sponsorship, marketing, digital disruptions. Oh, and Jada Mumju as well. Sorry, Jada. We're going to have a panel, so stay tuned for that, because it will be a continuation of this discussion. So I'm going to kick it to Rachel and Missy for some final thoughts on how do we kick it forward.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really looking forward to that next panel. And I was looking at a comment from Carrie here, who's talking about, you know, what do we do with resistance and what about bypassing the system entirely? And that's kind of the types of things I've been at least thinking about is just, you know, as much as I would like to retain like this sense of optimism when given the news today, I also know that there is resistance. There are kind of systematic barriers like to recognizing women's value, and those aren't disappearing just because this, you know, of this one particular win today, the win that took, you know, who knows how much money and, you know, blood, sweat and tears behind the scenes and years of people's lives to get to. And so it's like, okay, well, we know these barriers are here. I think a lot of the barriers exist in these connections between kind of sport entities and external entities, right? Like with their relationships with mass media and with corporate partners who don't necessarily share the types of values that we all do because we're here, right, together. And so I think like, how can we, you know, consider identifying these barriers and, you know, thinking about where our power lies as, you know, women athletes and advocates for women's sport to kind of bypass them perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we will talk about that in the next panel. And thanks for that, answering that question, because I know a lot of people that tuned in tonight are sort of on a similar page with us. And how do we reduce barriers? How do we work together? How do we capture this energy? How do we bypass systems of the status quo of the male model of sport that's created by men for men and privileges men. Missy, final thoughts from you.
So I'm going to go back to something I believe it was Megan Rapinoe said. She had a lot of quotable moments, but this stuck out to me and it relates to my answer to the question. So she said, I am who I am all the time. And that really rung true for me. And she talked about being incredibly passionate for the game of soccer. And like, she feels a strong connection. And I think for me, that it's a little idealistic, I know, but it's that idea of being really passionate to this idea of change and not giving up on it and finding a way to make that happen on a local level. And that was, for me at the USL, that's one of the really strong values that we have, is that connection to the clubs, whether they're at sort of the pre-professional level or the professional level for us, of connecting with that local community, because that's how you can create change then in these little pockets all around, right? And hopefully that then generates movement. And I think we all have that responsibility. So if you're passionate about the game, you're passionate about women's sports, you know, you're a fan, you work in it, you care about whatever your identity is around it, is to join in a little bit more and lean into it a little bit more. Whether you're someone who wants to rock the boat and kind of do the uprising and circumvent sort of the traditional ways, or whether you're someone that wants to, you know, join the movement by volunteering to help with a local sports organization that supports girls and women in sport, right? Even if you don't know how to coach, you don't know how, like, just step up and lean into that, because it is going to continue to take all of us. I do think this is, like I said earlier, a step forward, and there will be more steps that have to take. And I am kind of one of those, like, you know, bleeding hearts. That's like, we put all the steps together and it's going to make a difference. And some of that's from my experience in the sport over the last 25 years as a player and a coach. I didn't get the chance to play in a professional league. They didn't exist when I graduated from college. So I kind of missed that. And I'm committed to creating more opportunities for people. And I think everyone here is. And there's many of you out there who are. And so that's my sort of ploy, like, lean into your passions and don't think that, you know, don't sell yourself short. Like, you are who you are all the time, and you may not be Megan Rapinoe, but you can be in your own community in some way, shape or form. And don't devalue that. I think it's really important.
That's a really good point to end on, Missy. And I think the one reason why I put this panel together is we have different perspectives of the practitioner on the ground in the trenches who's had a career on all levels of soccer, to like a critical sports sociologist looking at systems change, right? And those both perspectives are valid. And when we meet in the middle and we think about how do we keep critiquing the system and pointing out the problems and not letting it go under the radar, and have that optimism and like, yes, we can do this. And I've seen the change. It's slow, but it does happen. And we all believe that change can happen. That's really what this is. And I see Dr. Nancy Lowe put a comment to the panelists, is this is a movement, not a moment. So the moment of this settlement is a moment, but when we come together as a movement, I think of stars in the sky. So think of one star here and one star there, but what happens when stars, and it's, you know, maybe bright or maybe it's dim, but when a bunch of stars come together, it's a constellation and it shines brightly. So that's what I feel is starting to happen from different perspectives. So I really, really appreciate this discussion and your perspective. So, and all of you that tuned in tonight, you are also part of those stars and those constellations. We can all create change. We can all be who we are. It doesn't have to be big change, but all little changes together lead us in a better way. So thank you all for joining us. We will be recording this. We will be posting it. So if you just didn't get quite enough of our insight the first time around, you can watch it again. And stay tuned for our other panel coming up in the next month and a half. If you haven't subscribed to the Tucker Center newsletter, or follow us on social, that's where you'll be able to see it. So I really do appreciate it and look forward to connecting with all of you again in the future.